Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And today it's conservation. Conservation, the movement, conservation, the principle, conservation, the trouble.
Conservation, the confusion.
Yeah.
There are so many of us on the planet now doing so many different things which affect the air and the water that the creatures on the planet can no longer really be uninfluenced by our presence. They can't be truly wild. And that made me wonder, well, if you want to give the other creatures on Earth a little more room to be wild and independent, then what do we have to give up? In fact, how much are we willing to give up to make that happen?
I don't know. These are tough questions. I mean, you know I'm not good at the answer part, right?
This is John Moalem.
I'm John Moalem. I wrote a book called Wild Ones, and I'm a writer with the New York Times Magazine.
And being a writer, he told me a story. Now, this is a story which shed some light on this question, but I think you'd have to say it's a difficult light.
So there was a family of whooping cranes that had been part of this
story. Revolves around a project to create a wild flock of whooping cranes.
One of the most spectacular birds in the world. It's 5 foot tall. It's pitch white, you know, with black wingtips. Got a 7 foot wingspan. Beautiful flyer.
This is Joe Duff.
I'm the co-founder of Operation Migration, the current CEO.
At one point, the whooping crane population in North America was down to like 15 birds, just one flock. So Joe and a bunch of other folks decided to see if they could start a new flock of cranes. So they raise some cranes in Wisconsin, and then they teach them a new migration route to Florida by leading them there in an ultralight airplane.
Yeah.
Joe, in addition to being founder and CEO, is also the lead pilot.
Right. I started flying with birds in 93. These are wild creatures. You know, we do this whole thing in full costume, so the birds don't hear voices. They don't see buildings or any other human paraphernalia in order to maintain their wildness.
Joe even wears an all-white crane-like costume when he's up there in the ultralight leading the birds down to Florida. And when they get to Florida,
the cranes are supposed to, you know, they're brought to this Chazahuitzka National Wildlife Refuge.
It's a coastal wetland. It's all salt marsh.
In the Tampa area.
And the birds are put into, it's called a release pen.
It has 12-foot high fences protected by electric wire, but the whole complex is not top netted. And so after a while, the birds realize they can fly out.
Then they go seek out their own territories.
It's called a gentle release into the wild.
Or the not so wild. And here's where the problem starts. It's the winter of 2007, and we've got a particular bunch of cranes.
This family, they were called the first family because they were the first cranes in the population to have a chick that they led south.
The first wild hatch migratory whooping crane in the U.S. since the last nest was reported in 1878.
And these cranes had wound up in this little subdivision.
A wetland complex that was surrounded by houses.
It was perfect crane habitat. It was basically a marsh. Just so happened that it was in this woman's backyard. And so the birds, which had been the product of this, you know, very intensive effort and tons of money.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars an hour.
To be wild whooping cranes were now just in her backyard. And there was free food there. She had all these bird feeders, this whole array of different bird feeders.
Well, why is this a problem?
Well, the problem is we're worried that the birds are going to become acclimated to people.
To be really safe, Joe says, these birds should be afraid of people.
Six of them have been shot, you know, by vandals.
Six and birds so have been shot?
Six whooping cranes have been shot in this project by vandals, yeah.
So what do you do?
We ask the people to stop feeding them.
Do you have like a reverse phone directory or you have a
Well, we track the birds. They're all tracked.
And so they knew exactly where they were.
And they were able to figure out that the cranes were in the backyard of
Clarice Gibbs. And, you know, they knocked on her door and explained, you know, the whole ins and outs of the project. And would you please take your bird feeders down? And she said no.
No?
Yeah.
Why would she say no?
Well, John talked to the people who went to see her. And
you know, they didn't say crazy, but you got the sense that there was this, you know, crazy old bird lady who lived in this house who would not take her feeders down.
They told John that they thought she was acting kind of erratic and that things just kept getting worse and worse.
And they had actually gone and put a plastic fence around one of her feeders at one point. They had thought she had given permission, but she had no memory of that. So it got bitter pretty fast.
And so John decided, I'm going to go talk to this woman.
Yeah, so I was sort of girding myself for a, you know, crazy old bird lady who lived in this house. But I went to go see her, and you know, it was a really emotional day for me. We sat at her dining room table, and she was having a lot of trouble remembering the exact chronology of what had happened when. She said, "Excuse me, I'm just, it's hard for me to kind of piece things together around that time." And basically the story emerged.
At that time,
when we heard that story, we decided we needed to talk to Clarice ourselves. So we called her up out of kind of the blue and asked her if we could record the conversation. We would love to do it.
Well, no, it wouldn't bother me at all. I wouldn't mind.
Okay. So you were about to say that you're, first of all, the description, how many bird feeders did you have in the backyard, would you say, roughly?
At that time, I think I had two or three in an oak tree that's here in our backyard. And where we live is, it's just, you know, it's a peaceful area, and birds like things like that. They don't like to be around a lot of congestion and stuff. And we enjoy them. Well, I say we. When my husband was alive, we both enjoyed the birds and feed every
This day. Is where the story flipped for me, because when those conservationists were knocking at Clarice's door, her husband of more than 50 years...
He had Alzheimer's, and they were sort of hunkered down at their house waiting for his life to end.
Yeah, this was before, the Alzheimer's took him really bad.
And what they were doing was spending a lot of time on their back porch, looking at the birds.
And we would come out here and sit with our tea or lemonade. He would just kind of watch. Our back porch, of course, faces the lake. We have a beautiful yard. We have oak trees. And as I'm sitting here talking to you, there's all kinds of birds around right now feeding.
Huh.
We even have sandhill cranes that have two babies with them.
So Clarice and her husband would be there on the porch, and if you have had this disease in your family, you know how painful it is, because here's her husband, and he is just disappearing a little bit and a little bit more, and then he's mostly not there. But when a bird or a bunch of birds come by the bird feeders, from wherever he was, he's back.
As soon as he would spot something, he'd say, "Babe, there it is. There's the hummingbird."
And when the whooping crane showed up, big and white and wild,
that would really get his attention, because they are such big, beautiful birds. You know, I could see a happiness in his eyes, and he would smile. Oh, to me, it was like, you know, he came back to me for a little bit when. When he would see things like this, it would make him so happy, and it would make me happy too to see how it affected him. I'm sorry. I get kind of choked up when I talk about him. We were married for 56 years when that disease took him, and it was hard.
From her point of view, it was like a miracle to see a bird like that, and the way that her husband responded to them, and just, you know, the way that they took his breath away, when really, you know, he wasn't responding to a lot else in the world.
It's a blessing, you know, when they seem to recognize things, and then you lose them again, you know?
Yeah. So that's why when the crane people showed up at her door and said, "Please take the bird feeder down," she said, "No."
You know, I left that house I just couldn't figure out how to make sense of it all once I'd left.
Have the people who visited her, having read your account, have they changed their minds at all about her or what they do? Because it's a toughie, this situation.
Yeah, I'm sure they would still believe that the birds shouldn't have been fed, but I don't know if they would be any more sympathetic to her now.
Well, you know, my father died of Alzheimer's, so I can respect exactly what she's going through and how difficult it is. However, the cost of that is the demise of a bird that other people have spent a huge amount of time, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for that entire bird's life until it was a year old, putting in the wild to help save a species.
But if you put yourself in her shoes, she says, she, by the way, was very careful.
I was very, very emphatic that we didn't mess with the birds because I knew they didn't want them being confronted with people, you know, because they are a wild thing and
so she stayed where she felt you'd want her to stay. But it's a hard one to ask that she give up a glimpse at her husband for the sake of the birds.
I suppose. I'm a little more pragmatic than that, unfortunately.
You would have him make an exception for her?
Well, at the very least, I would have him understand that she's in a unique place, that he's...
No, I don't think it's unique. Well, maybe she is in her particulars, but that is precisely the problem he has to deal with. Are people like her? She means well. We all mean well. It's not a case of, like, people with guns shooting these birds. I mean, that does happen, but I don't think that's the big problem.
No, these are two people who both love the bird but can't agree on something about
right.
it.
And he's saying in order to love the bird, you have to negate, you have to disappear. And we can't, as human beings, we don't seem to be able to do that.
We all have our own personal requirements, and we put those over and above anything else, including wildlife. And that's why wildlife is in such peril.
And that's the struggle. It's never going to go away. You know, no matter what happens with any of these species conservation projects, we're not going to strike some balance where we never have to think about the power that we're exerting in the world. This give and take, that's what it is. That's the end game. It's that forever.
Special thanks to Simon Adler, who ferried us through this whole project, and also to John Moalem, whose book, The Wild Ones, is the source of this story.
And coming up, another story from producer Simon Adler, that takes a look at a very different form of conservation.
Yes, and there will be killing. Yes,
this one involves
murder. Yeah.
Hello, this is Isabel and the birds calling all the way from Montevideo, Uruguay. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org. All right, guys. Ciao.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
And this is Radiolab. Today, we're talking about conservation, but not in the usual way.
Not at all.
Well, certainly not in this next story.
No, because here we're going to meet a guy who thinks he's a very, very serious conservationist, and we wonder whether you will agree with him.
Yeah. This story took a very long time to report, about 2 years. And it comes to you from reporter Simon Adler.
All right, so this story really started for me in Salt Lake City. This past February, I went to the Western Hunting and Conservation Expo, sometimes referred to as the Super Bowl of hunting. So I'm walking through this airplane hangar-sized room. It's at this massive convention center called the Salt Palace. Over 40,000 people there. Gun manufacturers, there were bow makers, there were duck call makers.
This one's a single reed.
Camouflage clothing apparel companies.
Well, this place is rocking, and I hope you're having a good time. And if you're having a good time, I want to hear a big yee-haw.
Yee-haw! Woo! As part of the expo, off this main floor, there was a banquet hall where there was an MC who was working the crowd.
Well, tonight, I want to continue on a couple of thoughts that we touched on last night. You know, our greatest conservation president, Theodore Roosevelt, said, "The wildlife and its habitat cannot speak for itself, so we must." Well, let me tell you, we have, and we will continue to speak, but we've got to go further than speaking. We're going to have to suit up in our armor to go into battle to protect our wildlife and our way of life. Well, let me tell you, we are at war brought on by the extreme radical environmental movement. If we're not vigilant and gauge this enemy, the most endangered species in America could be the American hunter.
Now, one of the things that surprised me kind of right off the bat was talking to people. Everybody kept coming back to this idea and hitting on this idea that, like, if it weren't for us, if it weren't for the hunters,
the animals would not be alive.
Without us hunting them, they would go extinct.
I got that line over and over again.
There would be no animals out there to hunt.
Basically, what they mean by this is they are the ones that are paying to keep these animals around. They are the ones who are funding conservation. And I saw what that looked like on the final night of the expo, Saturday night, when the organizers held this auction.
And now is the time to open your wallets. Get out your checkbooks, your credit cards. In fact, we'll even take IOUs written on the back of a napkin.
Let's make some money for wildlife, buddy.
Let's do it. Our first auction item tonight presented.
The first couple items, they were just like guns.
It's an American-made Ruger.
Rifles. But then
item number three, we're going to full curl stone.
The picture of this sheep pops up on this jumbo screen up on the stage.
Big stone sheep, as you can see right there. Right?
Big ones.
Big ones.
Huge curling horns. Thick brown coat.
Beautiful color. That's on the bucket list, brother. Yep. That's on the bucket list.
So the winner of this auction item, what they're actually buying is the chance to go up to Canada on this very specific area and to shoot one of these sheep, to get a tag to shoot one of these sheep.
I have an opening bid of $30,000. That's what I'm talking about. Let's go 32 and a half. 32 and a half. One dime, but I'm going to get 32 and a half for one of the best stone units there is. I'm 32 and a half down the middle. Need 35. One dime, but I'm going to get 5. 35,000. One time and last call. Sold him right over here, $35,000.
Like, how does the conservation angle work exactly?
So basically how this works is each state has an agency that's responsible for managing its wildlife.
Yes.
And so if you're a hunter, you basically have to buy a tag from that state agency in order to shoot just about any animal. For example, in Arizona is this grid of hunting areas, and you apply to a lottery. For Zone B, I would really like to be able to shoot a moose. You put your $20 in. This is typical. And
60,000.
If your name comes up, you get your tag for $20. But it's possible that you're not going to get one. And sometimes you have to wait 10 or 20 years, especially for these big game animals.
67 and a half.
So what these agencies do,
$70,000.
They set aside a certain number of these tags every year, which are called conservation tags. And what these conservation tags are is like, if you just give a bunch of money right now,
I did not see this coming.
You have free range to do what you want. Hop the line, shoot the animal you want, no waiting.
$80,000, he did it! He freaking did it!
And then all that money goes back to those state agencies for land management, habitat restoration. Like, we're talking millions of dollars that get raised this way. One auction item that I saw sold that night.
The special big game enhancement package.
Which basically gave whoever won it the right to shoot just about any animal in the entire state of New Mexico for a year.
I'm 175. I'll go 80. One time, but I'm going to have it 80, 80, now, but I'm going to have it 180. 180, now but again 90, one time, but now but again 90, 90, 90. Booyah! Sold it, $230,000.
Whoa.
Ladies and gentlemen,
that's close to
you. Need to do a sound check.
Yeah, I'll just get some levels.
And in fact, the whole reason I had come to this convention was to talk to a guy who had done an auction like this. But in his case, it kind of blew up on him.
I honestly did not expect to be in the position that I am today. My name's Corey Knowlton.
Corey Knowlton has become kind of the poster child of this idea of hunter conservation. He's a Texas millionaire. I met him in his hotel room right across the street from the expo. And story goes, back in January of 2014, he was at an expo super similar to this one, put on by the Dallas Safari Club.
I had my wife with me.
He was just walking the floor when he bumped into a friend of his.
A gentleman by the name of John Jackson. Okay, and John Jackson heads up a group called Conservation Force. So anyway, John came to me.
And he told Corey that he was worried that the Dallas Safari Club,
they were auctioning off an opportunity to hunt a black rhino in Namibia.
The Namibian Ministry of Environment and Tourism had given them one tag to hunt one black rhino. And they were going to auction it off. Now, the black rhino is a critically endangered species. There are about 5,000 of them in the world, about 2,000 in Namibia. And what the Namibian government does is they auction off the older males.
What happens is the black rhino gets older, it sees other rhinos, it wants to attack them oftentimes and kill them.
So the government will offer up those problem rhinos for trophy hunting and then use the money to protect the others from poachers.
Is poaching of the black rhinos a real issue?
Huge issue. Rhino horn right now, it goes, what's the number? $60,000 a pound.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's worth like three times as much as gold per ounce.
Damn.
In any case, Corey says the reason that John was so worried.
John said, Corey, there's been a giant push of people coming out against this.
It's literally a license to kill.
People don't want it to happen.
A permit to hunt down and kill one of the world's most endangered animals.
He said, I'm really worried that we're not going to have someone to bid this minimum bid.
His friend was worried that there were going to be these Namibian ministers there, and they just didn't want to be embarrassed.
So John asked me, he said, would you at least bid the minimum bid?
Just to sort of, like, get the auction rolling.
And as a friend, somebody that I've been friends with for over a decade, I said, yes, I would do that.
So, night of the auction.
They started this auction just like any other auction.
Eventually, Corey makes his bid.
$350,000.
Thinking that would just goad the other bidders.
That's right. I was like, you know what? I'm going to do what I told you. I'm going to follow through with my commitment. It's when all of a sudden...
Going once, going twice.
Boom, it happens. You know, I'm just me. I'm just Corey Knowlton. I'm just a guy. I take people hunting. But immediately, I've got people surrounding me. You know, a giant line of people congratulating me. But next 48 hours...
We now know who paid $350,000 for a hunting permit to kill an endangered black rhino in Namibia.
A barrage of threats started coming.
He's being bombarded with death threats.
Among the thousands of postings, I hope the rhino rips you in half. Do your children know what a monster their father is? I hope you get what you deserve, a short and painful existence.
Corey says people threaten to murder his parents, to rape his wife to death.
I'm coming to your house. I'm going to burn it down. I'm going to put your kids in a wood chipper, and I'm going to do it in front of you.
At any point in this, have you been super enthralled by the idea? Have you always wanted to shoot a black rhino?
I definitely haven't always wanted to shoot a black rhino. Have I always wanted to hunt for as long as I remember? Yes. Okay. I had a big journey in life. When I was born, we had literally nothing.
He told me he grew up in rural Missouri in a small house, then a trailer home. His mom raised the family. His dad loaded trucks at Safeway.
Okay. By the time I was 15, we had moved all over the United States.
His dad picked up jobs in Arizona, Texas.
I'm going from school to school to school. But the one thing I did is I had a dad that worked his butt off every day, and I didn't get to spend much time with him. So then when we would want to go do things, hey, Dad, let's go dove hunting. It's dove season. I looked at it as a privilege to go hunting. I didn't look at it like, hey, it's my right to go out and take some animal's life. Now, as I became older, I became more interested in hunting. I wanted to learn about bows. I wanted to learn about hunting. I was ate up with it.
By the time he was in his mid-20s, he says, and this was right around the time his dad hit it big in the oil industry, he was leading hunts all around the world.
From the North Pole to as far south as you could hunt in New Zealand.
Nepal.
Papua New Guinea. So I've seen the whole world.
And he says somewhere in the middle of all of those trips, he realized
that there's a big fight out there. This large biomass of humanity is taking over the world, and wildlife doesn't exist by accident anymore.
And so he started thinking about not just hunting these animals,
but preserving them and keeping them here.
All of which is to say, when he won that auction without meaning to and started getting all those death threats, he didn't turn back. What on earth is keeping you so steadfast in going ahead and doing this? I think I would have thought, I shouldn't have done this.
I was willing to do this, and it may have not been what I planned on, but I was willing to do this based on a commitment to I made to a friend. I made a commitment to conservation as a whole. Look, this was never about me going over and taking a black rhino's life. Like, finally, I get to achieve the zenith of life and killing this black rhino. Give me a break. It was about a method of conservation to keep black rhinos on the face of this earth.
You are saying that you're doing this for conservation. Your detractors will say,
they will say, you say you are only doing it for conservation when you are really doing it for...
I say I was only doing it for conservation.
No, I'm not saying that's what you've said. I'm saying that this is what they will throw at you. You are saying you're only doing it for conservation. Well, all you are actually getting out of it is some sort of satisfaction. And can you talk for a minute about...
Talk for more than a minute about it. Okay, all right. Sure. I enjoy the act of hunting. Can I tell you why? Could I wrap that up in a real pretty burrito for you to be able to eat and understand and it tastes good? No, but I can tell you that I care about the survival of these species.
And do you understand why people have a hard time wrapping their mind around that, you believing that, and simultaneously wanting to kill an animal?
We don't have one without the other, okay? If we want wildlife to be around for future generations, we have to understand that that wildlife has to have a value. If it doesn't have a value, especially in the continent of Africa, it's going to be gone.
And here he made a sort of economic argument. He said, you got to keep in mind that living next to a black rhino, not just talking about it, but actually living next to a black rhino, it's a nightmare.
I mean, who wants to live next door to a raging psychopathic beast that's killing things? No one.
So in just very purely economic terms, it has a negative value. But what Corey will tell you and what conservation organizations like World Wildlife Fund and various others will tell you is by him paying $350,000 to shoot one, he is creating a positive value for that animal. He's creating jobs for game wardens. He's creating jobs for trackers.
So you got to look at the net benefit. It's there.
Well, and so what is the common ground here? Because you guys want the same things, and yet there's somehow this...
No. We don't want the same things.
Conservationists in general do.
The common ground has to be, do you or do you not want to see black rhinos on the face of the earth?
And I think everyone agrees that they do, but I think even...
No, they don't.
No, I think they do.
Because their actions are speaking louder than their words.
They're all... I think to a lot of people, there are these neo-colonial sentiments here. That you are this guy who has a lot of money and you are paying a lot of money to go to Africa to shoot this thing. And I think that causes a reaction in certain people. Do you think the amount of money plays into it or no?
I'm going to take a break for one second.
Okay.
Well, you can say you don't want to answer anything or that...
No, I want to give you the best possible answer. Do you understand that?
No,
I'm trying. Okay, I'm really trying to an emotional level where I'm like, God dang, man. I want these people to get so bad. I just don't know if I'm going to be able to.
We can stop.
No, you don't have to stop. Just give me a second. And I know that the words that I put out mean something. And I don't want to do a disservice. And I feel like I'm letting people down. And I'm not a radical psychopath. You can see that. Okay, it's just something I believe in. I can believe in these animals, and I believe that I want them here. But I also understand that death is inevitable. But the death of the species doesn't have to be. And so I'm putting myself through this because I believe in that it's right, because I've seen that it's right. And I'll go down and I will sit next to people in Africa, both indigenous and non-indigenous, that have the exact same belief. And they want these animals. They love them. They want their kids to see it. They know that one night when the stars are above and they're sitting there with their family and a lion roars in a distance, they feel that. They feel what it means to be afraid of it. They feel what it means to respect it. They feel what it means to love it. And they want that to continue. And I want that to continue in a realistic view, a realist view. I believe I have a grasp on what it takes for that to continue.
Thank you for being so honest. I don't have any other questions.
Okay.
At that point, the hunt was totally in limbo. He was still receiving death threats. Animal welfare organizations like Humane Society of the United States were lobbying and petitioning to try to stop the hunt. And what it all really hinged on was a decision to be made by U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Under the Endangered Species Act, it's illegal to import the carcass of an endangered species into the United States unless you can prove that by killing and importing that animal, you are helping the species as a whole. So that's what U.S. Fish and Wildlife had to decide. Would Corey killing and importing that one black rhino help black rhinos as a whole? March went by, April, and then in early May, I got a text from Corey that just read, "Let's talk tomorrow."
Coming up.
Right there.
We take a trip.
My name is Courtney, and I'm calling from Johannesburg, South Africa. Radiolab is supported, in part, by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Back to our reporter, Simon Adler.
Okay, so days after getting that text message,
how you doing?
I land in Namibia, meet back up with Corey.
Today we're in Windhoek, Namibia. It's the 13th of May, 2015. This is Simon's big day to interview local officials, professional hunters, and any bum on the street that wants to comment.
We get through customs and everything, and immediately...
I'm Simon.
Simon, I'm Enti. Nice to meet you, man.
We're met by the PH, Hinti van Heerde.
The PH.
I am a professional hunter.
The professional hunter.
Requested by Corey Norton to assist him on his hunt.
He's sort of the manager of this entire project. Big dude, scraggly beard, short shorts.
We need to go and pick up our stuff.
He leads us out of the airport. So what does the day's agenda hold for us?
Sort chaos out.
Sorting chaos out, okay.
your chaos just started, my friend.
So we get in his truck, start driving. And do you mind if I ask you some questions while we drive here?
Bring it on.
And I immediately just realized what a headache putting all this together has been for him.
Oh, 10 million phone calls, meetings after meetings with Minister of Environment and Tourism, head office checking with local offices.
All to help them figure out which is the best rhino for Corey to shoot.
So they had their list.
And so how many, at this point, do you know exactly which one you'll be going after, or are there a couple?
The main place we've identified, there is two rhinos we can remove from that area.
Both male, aggressive, post-reproductive.
We're going to try to get on one of these two animals and try to remove it as professionally as we can possibly do.
Fast forward to the next morning.
It's 4:46 a.m. I doubt that Simon nor I got any sleep last night. First thing bringing down to the truck is a firearm and the ammunition. Big knives and things for so we can skin another rhino.
Morning. How are you?
Hinti was on the phone taking care of final details. And much to my chagrin, there was this crew of CNN reporters hanging around. Once everything was loaded, we took off for the airport.
Should I leave you here, Corey?
Yeah.
And I waved them off.
Okay. Happy hunting. Good
luck.
Thanks,
man.
You what?
What was that again?
You waved? I don't understand.
I wasn't able to go on the rhino hunt itself.
What?
I know.
Are you serious?
You seem disappointed.
What happened?
Number one, a hunting party can only be so large in Namibia. And with these three CNN guys there, the party was just full. But you also have to understand...
CNN!
I was in the country illegally. I had no press pass. I had no press visa.
Oh,
so
man.
This was like, oh, I've got to keep my head down. Okay, this is...
That is our fault. So are you telling me the story is over? Is that what you're basically saying?
No. Don't worry. Corey's personal cameraman. He promised to give me all of his audio. So we do have the audio and we'll get to that. But while they were headed up north, I actually ended up going east. And where I went, totally unexpectedly, made this model of conservation and how it works, like, really finally clicked into place for me. Do you mind just telling me your name and where we are?
Well, my name is André Swanepoel.
My name is Estelle Swanepoel.
I'm
Andre and Estelle Swanepoel own the Aru Game Farms, which are a series of huge swaths of land that they've fenced in. In total, they have like over 200 square miles of land that actually used to be filled with cattle.
And 15, 16 years ago, we converted into a game farm.
Basically, they decided to get rid of all the cattle and bring in all these animals. They've got giraffes, they've got two different species of zebra, wildebeest, artebeest. In all, they've got 29 different species. Including.
How many black rhino are on the property here?
Up until about 3 weeks ago, there were 10, and now we've got 11. So
one of the hunting guides, Steph.
Steph Joubert at the Aru Game Lodges in Namibia.
Told me that they actually just had a rhino born on the property. And in fact, they've had several throughout the years born on this property. And he took me out to find one.
We're going to look for signs and keep our eyes peeled. And
so what should I be looking for if I'm going to be of any help here?
Yeah, in the distance, it'll just look like a big gray rock. You really got to have a keen eye.
We're driving through this really tall, thick grass that kind of enveloped the car. It was almost like we were driving through a cloud.
So this is the Kalahari sour grass. It's a real thick. It's almost like the mice can run on top of it.
Is your mic?
Yeah.
And after searching and searching and searching,
we've just spotted the rhino.
Oh, there it is, like 100 yards away. Oh man, okay. It's pointing at us.
He's noticed us now, he's probably heard the vehicle. So, you know, we're still at a very safe distance. I wanna get us into the shade and then we can have a closer look and you can put the binoculars up and take a real good look at it.
Oh man, looking through the binoculars and he's just pointed straight at us. His head's moving left to right, left to right.
I think this is a bull by the looks of things.
God, it looks like a dinosaur, doesn't it?
It is a very prehistoric looking animal.
He knew you were there?
Oh yeah, he was totally looking at us. I'm going to put the binoculars on and see. He's trotting away from us.
It started moving away from us, and they've got these tiny looking legs, so when they run, they have to kind of shuffle along.
I think if the grass wasn't there, you would laugh at him the way they move. It is quite comical. Very lucky to have found one.
Jesus. So we were tailing behind it, and the crazy thing is this huge animal that weighs like over a ton.
Oh, and it is on the move.
This thing can move like 30 miles per hour.
We're currently driving at about 15 kilometers an hour, and he's getting away from us.
Kind of left us behind.
So he wants nothing to do with us. He's moving off.
At one point before it took off, we actually got close enough that with the binoculars on, Steph was able to get a good look at its ear.
The bulls that were put there initially have all got earmarks. And this one doesn't actually have an earmark in it, so perhaps this one was born on this property.
So how does that work? How did the rhinos get to be on this property?
The Ministry of Environment and Tourism had been in touch with the owner of Aru Game Lodges.
Government said, hey, you've got all this land. Will you take a couple of these rhinos and protect them for us? And they said, sure.
You know, we started off with a couple, three rhino, and the numbers grew.
And it becomes this, like, strange foster care type situation.
Yeah, each year we have to take photos of them and we build up a portfolio and then we can send it into MET.
It's interesting that, like, they are breeding here. So there are more of them now than there would have been if they hadn't been moved here, yeah?
Yes, exactly. And another thing, we were unlucky last year. We lost two rhinos.
Steph said he wanted to show me something. Drove for about 10 minutes. Then he stopped the car at this small clearing, almost no grass, one lone tree.
Kind of an eerie feeling. That's what I sort of feel when I stumble across this place.
Oh, man. And can you just describe what we're looking at right here?
Bones scattered all over the red sand of the Kalahari.
Bleach white bones against red, red sand.
See the femur, we can see some parts of the spine as well.
Is that a rhino skull?
Yeah. The sheer size of it is just unreal.
Wow.
Did you see that there?
We got out of the car and actually held these bones.
Oh God.
Wow. How did that happen?
And it was the dominant bull. It was fighting with a younger bull.
The two squared off, and the older one ended up goring the younger one with its horn, or at least we think.
Unfortunately, the young bull passed away.
So it killed it.
Yeah.
Then this older bull that had just killed the younger one
Steph told me it then went up to this female.
Wanted to reproduce, and the young female wasn't ready. She wasn't mature enough yet.
He kept forcing himself on her over and over.
Until she couldn't any longer. I guess it would happen in nature as well. It's just unfortunate that it had to be, yeah. So yeah, they would have been even more, but nature took its course. We didn't get involved, and that's how it is.
Steph explained to me that it was these type of black rhinos, these older, aggressive bulls that get auctioned up for guys like Corey to come over and shoot.
And then all the money that's been paid for it is going back, all going back into anti-poaching units, is going back into conserving rhinos. And it's nice to see such a large sum of money coming in for a good cause.
So he believes in this program.
But personally, I'd never be able to shoot a black rhino.
I don't know. Well, and why? What about you personally wouldn't shoot a rhino?
For me, I don't know. I can't really explain why. No, I don't know. It's difficult to say. But no, I just doesn't tickle me.
Over the next couple days at the lodge, as I was hanging out with kind of these tourists from all over the world who had come here to be wined and dined and then go out and shoot stuff in the morning and afternoon, Steph's ambivalence started to make a deep sort of sense to me. For instance, I spent a lot of time with this guy.
Yeah. Stefan Lindström. I'm from Sweden.
Middle-aged, there with his family on vacation.
We decided 6 years ago that we will go to Africa. So I'm very happy to be here today.
This is 6 years in the making for you.
Yeah, you can say so.
He works in Volvo's corporate office, and he's a big trophy hunter.
Maybe I should show you some picture from my home.
Do you have lots on the wall already?
It's 30. At home, it's 30. And after the camp, we have at least 50 more.
I got to follow him on a few hunts, him and his guide.
My name is Benjamin Scriver. Scriver is my surname.
One of the hunts, we spent about 2.5 hours searching for different animals, stalking different animals, and then in the distance,
we saw a very nice waterbuck bull there.
We finally found a waterbuck.
Which is what?
It's kind of like a reindeer, but it has these two big long horns that kind of shoot backwards, almost like spears.
Big animal.
Yep, big animal. But I just do not know how old he is, so we're just going closer and see.
We hop down from the car and just start kind of slowly moving towards it through the grass.
This type of animal is the top for me this weekend, this holiday.
Stefan told me he had a list of animals he was hoping to shoot, and this was at the top of it.
This one, I think it's such a beautiful big animal. That's why.
The game lodge charges $2,800 to shoot one.
Okay, the water bug is here, sir. He's right. Straight.
Okay.
Okay, let's go and see.
Okay.
So at the moment, there's light wind. We're walking through shin-length grass. There are shrubs to the left and the right.
Every, like, 10 minutes, we'd stop to measure how far away it was.
It's about 600 meters. 600 meters. I think it will take about 20 minutes to come rather close to them.
Okay.
Eventually, we got just a couple hundred feet away from it. The animal's off in the distance. It's just kind of pacing.
You wanted to stand still.
Ben pulls out this tripod, sets it up, and Stefan gets into position.
He's standing behind. He's dead. No. Stop. Please stop. That's the right one.
Yep.
The buck stumbles a few paces.
I mean, he's down.
Yeah, he's down. Imagine.
Falls down, but then it gets right back up and stumbles forward.
Put another bullet
in? Yeah, I have it. One in.
This one in?
Yeah, that's secured.
The okay. First shot didn't kill it.
I was needing to shoot rather high because it was a lot of grass.
At this point, Ben seems tense.
He doesn't like that, I think. I don't care.
Because, like, he knows that the animal is suffering. So the dog takes off, runs after it, and just keeps it at bay by kind of circling it, and we start moving towards it.
Let's go closer.
Nice try.
Just wait. Relax.
It goes away.
Again, second shot doesn't kill it. Falls down, gets back up, falls down again.
Down or? It's down. It's up.
No, just relax. Relax and just.
It's writhing in the grass.
Ben now seems pretty upset.
I don't know where you shot it the first time, but.
Rather high. He's looking at the right.
Yeah.
And the third shot doesn't kill it.
Just wait.
This is not fun. This is not fun. I see the dog.
I can shoot him in the neck.
I will try.
Okay. Finally, fourth shot, it goes limp.
Damn. What's so many shots?
It's lying on the ground. Its leg is still kicking a little bit, but it's done.
Oh, it's so nice.
Yeah, that's what
I am so happy. I'm so happy. I mean, this was the top of the list for me this weekend. So this hunt is perfect. It's very nice feelings.
So, seeing it up close, it can be emotionally difficult. But when you pan out, it's pretty clear. The numbers show that this Namibian model is working. Wildlife numbers on private land have gone up by almost 80% since the government allowed people to buy, sell, and shoot wildlife on their land. And since trophy hunting of the black rhino was legalized, that population has grown by like 30%. But
front of my face.
Not all African conservationists are on board. I talked to a guy named Richard Leakey, a super famous anthropologist, who also directed Kenya's wildlife program for a while. And I asked him, what is your stance on this idea of sustainable use of wildlife?
Listen to me. I think it's utterly ridiculous. You know, if a father can't afford to pay school fees for his children, does he say to somebody, you can rape my daughter so I can get the money to pay for her school fees? I mean, I think we've got to set some standards in life, and I think this is nonsense, what this argument is about. Killing wild animals so that they can be looked after absolutely sends the wrong message.
This was the big issue he took with Namibia's strategy.
Yes, you can afford to lose five rhinos from a breeding perspective, but does that send a right message?
He then told me a story about when he took over Kenya's wildlife service in 1989. At the time, things were dire.
Elephants were being killed at an alarming number, and we were going to lose our elephants totally.
Poaching was on the rise, and his predecessors had actually confiscated a huge number of elephant tusks from these poachers.
12 tons. Wow. If you saw it, you thought, that's a lot of ivory.
And they recommended to him, sell this ivory, make about $3 million, and then use that money to help fight poaching. But Leakey said no. What he did instead was he built a giant tower out of that ivory.
And set fire to it.
Millions of dollars in ivory taken by poachers burned.
More than 12 tons of contraband elephant tusks.
12 tons of illegally poached ivory worth several million dollars.
It burned for 3 days. It got television, it got newspaper, it got magazine, it got radio.
It was this massive PR stunt to draw the world's attention to the plight of elephants. And part of what he was saying in that was, like, we have to value these things beyond their dollar value. We have to respect the intrinsic value of these creatures.
But wait a second. If you're burning a bunch of ivory, aren't you, in effect, increasing the value of the ivory because now there's just less of it out there?
Well, so you're looking at the supply end of it, right? Yes, by reducing supply, that would push up price. Leakey was attacking the demand side.
What an impact it had around the world. Opinion changed overnight.
He said it woke the public up. People stopped buying ivory, and the market for ivory, it just crashed.
Up to that time, we'd been losing about 3,500 elephants to 4,000 elephants a year.
Mm-hmm.
And a year later, we were losing at most 60.
Really?
It had an enormous impact, my friend. Getting a public that supports conservation of wildlife, that's a huge challenge. And we just can't afford, I think, to send out the wrong messages.
But the problem with that is finding the right message is getting harder and harder.
I called various conservation organizations, and one guy who I talked to told me that their average age of donor is getting older. More and more people are just living in cities. Less people are having positive experiences in the natural world at a young age. And so he said that they're going to have to continue focusing on people, focusing on us. This message of, what does wildlife give us? What does it do for people?
This is our third day up in the area. Still no luck, and we're just going to keep at it.
Back in Namibia, after 3 days of bushwhacking through this dense vegetation up in the north of the country, Corey and his crew finally got on the tracks of the right rhino.
The local guy says, we found a rhino that had killed another rhino that had killed another rhino. So we're going to follow this one, make 100% sure that it's the right one, and then we'll try to take it if we can.
So for the next couple hours, they track the animal, looking for basically footprints, anywhere that has marked its territory.
So we've been tracking this thing for probably a couple hours now, and we've bumped it at least twice.
We had walked at this point just about 12 miles. It was very hot.
You can see how thick it is right here. Pretty dense.
The grass was so thick that they really couldn't see more than about 30 feet in front of them. And eventually they find...
You can see this is the rhino's...
A pile of rhino feces that's still warm.
It's still very moist. I mean, it's fresh. This is, we're not more than an hour behind that animal right there, and you can see the dung beetles and everything in it.
And so,
this animal's already angry.
We sat there for a few minutes, right? Gathered our thoughts.
There's not a single gun that can.
So then let's, you line it out. We're going to do what you say.
And then,
about 2 hours later,
I heard some noise from my left. All I see is a running beast with a giant saber on its head. It was like lightning.
So he also didn't get it with the first shot.
The first several shots did not kill this thing. It ran off, and then they had to start tracking it again.
Was it just wounded? Or?
Yes. We followed it, I would say 10 minutes, I don't know. I looked over there, I saw it.
Was it lying down at this point?
It was standing up, but it had already fallen down twice. It was dying. And then... I shot it a few more times. The last thing you do is once you're really assured it's dead, you touch its eye. And if it doesn't blink, it's gone.
So did you go touch its eye?
Absolutely.
In a moment like that, is there some sort? Is there a conversation going on now that the animal is dead and you're not?
No, we just kind of looked at everybody, looked at each other, made sure we were okay. There wasn't a whole lot of talk right then in this case, but it was an emotional moment for me.
So, the meat, we've been sitting here skinning this animal so far this morning, and now we're about to roll it over, skin the other side, and then just take the quarters off, just like any other animal that you would if you were on a hunting trip.
Okay, let's go. Okay. One, two, three,
They loaded up all the meat to be shipped off to a local village, and they kept a little bit of it for themselves.
So cooking my first piece of black rhino meat here on the coals next to the carcass, right here's the moment when everybody here has started eating some of this black rhino. So it's just a part of hunting and a part of being a human. So it's a pretty unique and awesome moment right here.
I'm not really morally outraged by it. Maybe I'm a little, but I think you might be vulnerable if you insist that your enthusiasm for hunting is part of the balance of nature. But I think it's
Robert,
a perfectly...
You don't have those canine teeth for eating salad. And I understand that people don't like it any more than they wouldn't like going and killing the lamb of the lamb chops they eat.
Well,
but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. Hunting, it's part of who we are. Now, it may be a bigger part of who I am than you are, and that's fine. But when wildlife populations abound is when they're managed by human beings.
The alternate model might be a view of humans that's different from yours. I think... You assume that because we are smart and because there are so many of us, that inevitably we will bump into them. And when we do, we will win. And thus your calculations. The alternate model might be that because we are smart, we might create a space where we won't bump into them.
Now you're not in a real world. We're dealing not in reality. Okay, I'm living in a world that matters and that's real. So it's not a dream scenario, and it's not saying, okay, well, let's just create this. Unfortunately, these animals don't have that time. So I'm not trying to outsmart anybody. It's just a traditional method that's worked. And until somebody comes up with a methodology that we could look at and say, this is a better way, I'm going to continue to fight and believe in the traditional model. So now we're going to ask ourselves these questions. How do we really, on an individual basis, value this animal's survival on Earth? Do you really value it? Do you value it past making 75 characters into your iPhone and tweeting about it? Do you value it past watching Animal Planet? To me, I know and I care, and I placed an extreme value financially, physically, emotionally on the survival of the black rhino.
Reporter and producer Simon Adler. We had considerable production support for this piece from Matthew Kielty, who also contributed some original music. Special thanks to Chris Weaver, Ian Wallace, Mark Barrow, Ryan Tarbett, the Lindstrom family, and everyone at the Aru Game Lodge in Namibia. We also want to take a moment right now to say...
Oh, yes, we do.
Goodbye and good luck to our dear, 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 longtime collaborator, Ellen Horn.
She's been with Radio Lab longer than me, right? She was there before... I remember when you were going to... when you were bringing her on, but we were still having breakfast in those days.
Yeah, you and I were just about to work together. She was the first person I brought in as an intern and then hired, and then she became the executive producer.
She's brought us through all... If you've been to any of the tours, she made those tours happen. If you've seen us on stage, she made the stage things happen when we were on the tours.
Yeah, she's just been that third partner from the beginning. Yeah. And now she takes her awesomeness to Audible.com, and we think they made a smart move.
So you should watch your ears, because they're about to get another blast of beauty from her, from some other source, somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good, because the world can only use more.
Absolutely. We are so proud and happy and grateful, and we love you, Ellen.
Yeah.